and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy. We strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Our podcast explores topics that relationship-based therapists care about. In addition to featuring unique conversations and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Common sexual problems that arise in couples therapy, we all know, are low desire and a desire discrepancy between partners. And according to today's guest expert, Dr. Barry McCarthy, the key to rekindling desire for women and men is to learn to value intimacy, pleasure, and eroticism combined with realistic sexual expectations. So in this episode of the AAMFT podcast, we confront the traditional male-female power struggle over intercourse frequency and replace it with a new understanding in which both partners value affectionate, sensual, playful, erotic, and touch. Barry also discusses good enough sex, which replaces the standard pass-fail intercourse model. And this approach affirms multiple roles, meanings, and outcomes of a couple's sex life. The encounter doesn't end in intercourse. Instead of feelings of failure, panic, or anxiety, the couple should celebrate the pleasure they have experienced, he contends. Let me tell you a little bit about Barry. He's made major contributions to the field of sexology and sex education and couples therapy. He's taught courses in human sexuality and psychological well-being at American University, where he was recognized as an outstanding professor, publishing over 20 books, 32 book chapters, and over 100 journal articles all around integrating sexuality and couples therapy, advancing sexual health, and enhancing sexual desire. He's co-authored a couple very popular books with his wife, which we will mentioned toward the end of the episode, Emily McCarthy. Those books, Rekindling Desire and Discovering Your Couple's Sexual Style. Barry has received from the Society of Sex Therapy and Research the 2016 coveted Masters and Johnson Award for a lifetime contributions to the sexuality field. Dr. McCarthy received his diplomat in clinical psychology from the Board of Professional Psychology as well. And following the sage advice of another one of his great colleagues and collaborators, the late Michael Metz, Barry retired from practice to devote himself to writing, presenting workshops, and enjoying his family life. And with Michael Metz, he collaborated on the Good Enough Sex Model, which is an integration of positive psychology, gender equity, and relapse prevention. I learned a lot. Hope you will too, and we'll be back after our interview with Barry McCarthy. For us therapists burdened by manual note-taking, Blueprint's AI note-taker offers a solution. It listens, transcribes, and automatically writes progress notes, freeing up to 5 hours of your time a week. This extra time can be used for client care or self-care. Join the thousands of therapists already using Blueprint and start your free trial at joinblueprint.com/MFT. That's joinblueprint.com/MFT. Or simply search for Blueprint AI Note Taker. Eli, back with you on the AAMFT podcast. So happy to welcome to the show Dr. Barry McCarthy, and we are talking about today working with couples, sexual desire, and for many therapists, working with desire problems, desire disorders is even much more challenging than typical sexual dysfunction or arousal disorders. We'll talk about that today. We'd like to know about our expert. Talk to us about your therapeutic origin story, so to speak, your journey into psychotherapy. working with couples and specifically couples around sexual issues?
I was a very lucky psychologist in that I got my PhD in 1969, Southern Illinois University, and in 1970, Masters and Johnson wrote Human Sexual Inadequacy, which I see as the birthplace of the sex therapy field. When I left, I came to Washington and to teach at American University. One of the things that they allowed me to do is if you create a new class, you got an extra bonus and you taught it in intersession. And so I taught a human sexual behavior class in 1970. There wasn't even a textbook in human sexuality. Now, when I, in terms of the psychology part and being a therapist, I was trained in usual approaches, including cognitive behavioral and psychodynamic approaches. But that what really interested me was to try to integrate general psychotherapy with sexuality. And in 1971, one of the first female therapists Masterson Johnson trained came to Washington to do a presentation over a year period, four presentations about sex therapy. And I was really caught into that. And that became my specialty in the sexuality field and became my specialty in the general mental health psychotherapy field. And it was one of the best decisions I've made. And I really find it a fascinating subspecialty. When sexuality works well in people's lives and in people's relationships, it plays a positive integral role, but it's a small role. I talk about it as a 15 to 20% role that energizes the couple bond and allows you to feel desire and desirability. But when sexuality is problematic or dysfunctional, but especially when it's avoided, it plays an inordinately powerful negative role. It really destabilizes the relationship. That one of the lines that I like the best is that good sex cannot save a bad relationship, but bad sex can subvert and destroy a healthy relationship. And then when I train and supervise marriage and family therapy people, I emphasize integrating sexuality into their couple work. And that the most important issue in that is sexual desire. The most common problem that brings couples to therapy sexually is low desire or desire discrepancy. And that can and should be addressed by MFTs.
I love it. And it's a feeder into our theme today. Let's orient our listeners. What do you think are the major factors contributing to low sexual desire? And what does the research tell us about low sexual desire?
It's the most common problem. 50% of married couples and more than that of non-married couples report sexual dysfunction or dissatisfaction. But the idea that people are doing, in 1970, Masterson Johnson had a prediction that unfortunately turned out to be untrue. And that is that sex was going to be so much better in people's lives by the year 2000 because we had more knowledge. We do have more knowledge, but we haven't applied it in ways that motivate and empower couples. And that I blame some of that on the sex therapy people because they overemphasize eroticism. But I blame a lot of that on the MFT people because what they say to couples is as long as there's good communication, intimacy, and security, sex will go well. And it's not true. That's a really important issue. That in fact, one of the side effects of good couple therapy, especially intimacy-based couple therapy, is you can create inhibited sexual desire because you wind up feeling so close and so emphasis on mutuality that you de-eroticize your partner in your relationship. And you say the only acceptable sex is mutual synchronous sex. And that again is untrue. So that when I think about healthy sexuality and how it functions in people's relationships, healthy sexuality blends intimacy, pleasure, and eroticism, three very different phenomena, but they need to be blended if you're going to maintain healthy sexuality in an ongoing relationship. And that's true whether you're talking about married couples or partnered couples, whether you're talking about straight couples, gay couples. That's the challenge, is how you integrate these three different aspects. And the problem with much of the MFT's issue is that you emphasize intimacy at the expense of pleasure and eroticism rather than integrating.
So much there that you said, and I think a lot of what good couples therapists do to set the table for their work with their clients is psychoeducation. So you're debunking a myth around if we just communicate better and if we're emotionally intimate, we'll be more physically intimate, which I think a lot of relation-based therapists and MFTs tell their couples. Our listeners always like to take away some things from a podcast. How would you psychoeducate a couple that you were working with around what you're saying at the beginning to really hit all three of these areas?
Well, one of the best things to do to say to people is, where are you strongest? Are you strongest at intimacy? Are you strongest at pleasure? Are you strongest at eroticism? And also, where are you most vulnerable? Where are you weakest? So that we're going to try to say to them that sexuality in some ways is simple, but in most ways is fairly complex. Don't go with the notion that everybody should have great sex every time. That sets you up to fail. You want to have positive, realistic sexual expectations. And you also want to ask them, and I have a different language, and I think many couples find the language valuable. Or I say to them, when in your relationship did desire, pleasure, eroticism, and satisfaction function the best? You know what the typical answer to that is? The first 6 months we were a couple, even before we got married. What I try to help them understand is that the limerence phase, the kind of new energy sex phase, romantic love, passion, sex idealization, is a wonderful experience, but it doesn't set you up to maintain sexual desire in an ongoing relationship, marriage or otherwise. That the question becomes, in an ongoing relationship, how you develop a couple sexual style that is the right fit for you. And the right fit for you means, again, that it honors both intimacy, pleasure, and eroticism, not every time, but where you feel capable of all of them. That it's okay to have sexual experiences that are erotically based. It's okay to have sexual experiences that are intimacy based.
Now, let's define, because I think a lot of our potential clients may lump those things together, or especially pleasure and eroticism. And maybe some of our listeners, our therapists might too. How would you define the difference between intimacy, pleasure, and eroticism?
Think about positive sexual feelings on a 10-point scale. 0 is neutral. 10 is orgasm. What intimacy is about is feeling connected, feeling meaningful, feeling safe with each other. And in terms of that 10-point scale, intimacy gets you from 1 to 3. When you think about pleasure, the essence of sexuality is giving and receiving pleasure-oriented touch. Pleasure is about 3 to 6 on that 10-point scale. It's feeling good about yourself, good about your partner, and its emphasis is on touch rather than spontaneous desire. We need to come back to that, because what many clients believe, what clinicians believe, is a spontaneous desire is more genuine and better than responsive desire. But empirically, that's false. Responsive desire is the essence of sex in ongoing relationships for many couples. Both of them are good, but this idea that responsive desire is second class is ridiculous. Responsive desire, especially for couples over 40, is most important. Pleasure gets you from 3 to 6, where you really are enjoying the experience. And it's a process of enjoying it, not a performance. And then eroticism means high intensity, high sensations. And that is, in terms of our scale, between 7 and 10, 10 being orgasm. You allow yourself to really get into an erotic flow. Now, let me say something historically. I have great respect for Masters and Johnson. They're the grandparents of the sex field, but they missed the core issue. The core issue sexually is desire, and the second core issue is pleasure and satisfaction. What Masters and Johnson believed, as long as you had functional sex, desire would take care of itself. And again, I'm always in favor of arousal and orgasm, but functional sex alone is not what promotes desire. You've really got to focus on positive anticipation, a sense of sharing pleasure, a sense of unpredictability in your sexuality. That's what keeps sex alive in ongoing relationships. So when couples say, my best sex was the first 6 months, I say, did you never develop a couple sexual style? And that's going to be the challenge of our therapy now. And one of the most helpful things for clinicians, MFT clinicians specifically, is to understand that your relational style and your couple's sexual style are often going to be different. I believe that Sue Johnson and John Gottman are right, that for the great majority of couples, the best friend relational style is the best way to go. But it's not the best way to go sexually. The complementary couple sexual style is a much better way to go sexually, that you maintain your own sexual voice, your own autonomy, and you integrate that into your relationship. So this notion about sexuality is that it, in some ways it's simple, and in other ways it's very complex. The simple part is you want to take a pro-sexual stance. The complex part is teaching people to value all three dimensions of sexuality. That sex is not a performance, it's a couple experience of giving and receiving pleasure.
It's interesting you've done much pioneering work on male sexual desire, specifically in men, especially as they age. They think about sex, as you were saying, this very performance, almost this autonomous male sexual response. And when they can't perform, it becomes very frustrating for the man and for the couple. So we're going to talk about desire, but I really like your work with men in talking about these kind of sensitizing events or failures, and then how an individual and a couple kind of recovers from that. I think that's pretty important to share with our listeners. Talk about specifically around male issues leading to desire.
For the great majority of men, they learn sexual desire different than their female partners. They learn sexual desire is tied to a spontaneous erection, a highly predictable spontaneous erection. Most men don't think about or worry about desire. They worry about arousal and orgasm, both theirs and their partner's. And most men want the woman, in terms of heterosexual couples, they want the woman to sexually respond the way they respond, which is one orgasm during intercourse. That is not a good pattern for the great majority of couples, but it does work for younger males. Now, what happens for most men, again, there's always exceptions. Remember, note one sexually one size never fits all. Sometime between age 35 and 55, the man has his first sensitizing experience. What that means is he doesn't have an erection sufficient for intercourse. Now, in a healthy man, in a healthy couple, they do not panic about that. They see that as a normal part of sexuality. And they now are more aware and better lovers after that sensitizing experience. They don't fall into ED, but a significant number of males become anxious and develop performance anxiety and anticipatory anxiety, which really interferes with desire. And as soon as he gets an erection, he wants to immediately transition to intercourse so he doesn't lose the erection. And that puts him on a slippery slope of it that leads to erectile dysfunction.
Another thing that I've noticed that happens after that, couples either the man will apologize or there will be a certain amount of anger. And some couples have their worst, most stigmatizing interactions after a failed sexual experience, which also further diminishes desire and leaves a really bad, negative experience and makes it worse.
Absolutely worse. You get into a terribly negative cycle where instead of sharing pleasure with your partner, you're worried about performing for her and being afraid of negative reactions. And her interpretation with erections is the interpretation that often that he's no longer turned on by me. I'm too fat. I've had too many kids. We've been together too long. And that's not what causes erectile dysfunction. What causes it is anticipatory and performance anxiety. And what you need to do, and this is the big difference in couple sex therapy as opposed to general couple therapy, is that you teach them a different way of being a sexual couple, where they're intimate and erotic allies and working together, that erectile dysfunction is a joint challenge. And we say to the man, never apologize and never panic. You want to develop in a positive way erectile self-efficacy. What promotes psychologically, biomedically, and especially relationally, what promotes good sex? And the major thing that promotes good sex relationally is you see your partner as your intimate and erotic ally. That is crucial, not somebody to perform for. And you also get to understand that it's one of the hardest of all the exercises, psychosexual skill exercises, is teaching them to practice waxing and waning of erections. I've done this with at least 1,000 men. My colleague before he died, Mike Metz, did it with about twice as many. We've never done it with a man or a couple that have enjoyed the exercise, but it's a crucial exercise because the way to think about it is an anti-panic exercise. That it's normal for you to lose an erection and you can regain an erection. And that the key to erectile self-efficacy is understanding that most of the time, sex is going to flow from comfort to pleasure to eroticism to intercourse and orgasm. But when it doesn't flow, rather than stopping being sexual, you transition to either a sensual or a erotic non-intercourse scenario. And you're basically saying to yourself and to your partner that I want to turn towards you, not away from you. I don't want to panic or go away. I want us to share pleasure with each other. Again, it sounds so easy on a podcast. It's actually very complex and challenging with real life people. But knowing and having confidence, that's the approach. And this includes the approach with men whose erectile problems involve medical issues, whether it's diabetes, cancer, whatever. As you can continue to be sexual in your 60s, 70s, and 80s, but you can't do it the old traditional way that that sex is defined as intercourse within your first erection. You can't return him to that. You can make him a better lover. You can make them a more understanding and supportive couple. And when sex doesn't flow to intercourse, you don't need to panic or apologize.
Yes, and you're normalizing these sensitizing events as part of a couple's sexual evolution and maturation. We have listeners to the show from their early 20s into their late 80s that I've heard from in correspondence. I do think what you're saying now is developmentally an easier sell to our older clients, but I am now 46 and many of the population I work with, 30s, 40s, early 50s, it's not as normalized. If they can't perform or they are having problems with arousal, even their desire, it is much more pathological than as you're aging gracefully into this different sexuality. So how would you talk to a couple in their early to mid 40s around what we're talking about?
Say to them is if you can learn this new way of being sexual friends, if you can learn that sexuality is not just about intercourse and orgasm, that sexuality is about intimacy, pleasure, eroticism, including erotic non-intercourse sex as well as intercourse, that if you can learn it now in your 40s, you will inoculate yourself from sexual problems in your 60s, 70s, and 80s. I said that when I was 27 years old, first writing about these issues. I'm now 80 years old, and so I still write about these issues. I think you're right that it's easier for males over 40 to accept this than it is for younger males. But even with younger males, it isn't unusual to have a sensitizing experience. And again, rather than setting up this performance anxiety cycle, you can turn to your partner as your intimate and erotic ally and say, we've got to learn a new way of being sexual that really works for us, not just me individually, you individually, but us as a couple. And it integrates into our approach to sex. We want sex to play that energizing, validating role in our relationship.
Wonderful. Now, another part of your work that I really appreciate around the five dimensions of touch, you call it the five gears. I think it's important to educate our listeners to the five gears of touch.
Okay, so we talk about, again, that 10-point scale. So think about gear number one is affection. I'm a big fan of affection, but affection is not sexual. Affection anchors you at a one. It connects you. The second gear is sensual touch. Sensual touch meaning non-genital touch. And sensual touch meaning it can be giving, a receiving, or doing both. What allows you to feel open and willing to emphasize touch as the key to desire rather than spontaneous erections or erections, period. The third gear is playful touch, and that integrates non-genital and genital, and that allows you to go from 3 to 5 or so in terms of pleasure. The fourth gear is erotic non-intercourse touch, and that involves manual oral rubbing stimulation or vibrator stimulation. And then the fifth gear is intercourse. But so many couples only have two gears. They have affection and they have intercourse. That one of the most valuable things is to learn at least another gear, and ideally all 5 gears, that values all different kinds of touch and understands that sensual, playful, and erotic non-intercourse touch are all sexual. It isn't intercourse or nothing. The most important thing about intercourse is do not transition to intercourse until your subjective arousal is ideally an 8, 7 at the minimum. So many men rush to intercourse because they worry about their erections. And so they wind up on inadvertently setting themselves and the partner up for failure. The other thing is that sex does not have to end at the male's orgasm. Traditionally, that's what's happened. But is the man interested in and his partner interested in afterplay, whether it's a sensual touch, playful touch, or erotic non-intercourse touch? So that they have now not just a new language, but new scenarios and techniques that they can integrate that allows them to feel, again, like both intimate friends and erotic friends. So many people think of their spouse as their intimate ally, their intimate friend, but not their erotic friend. So we want to integrate eroticism for the woman and the man. And again, these same concepts apply to alternative sexualities. That is, sexual or gay or lesbian couples, bisexual plus couples, or couples that have a variant or kink arousal.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think what a good couples therapist working on the sexual relationship does is psychoeducate, as you've been doing this hour, and then facilitating the dialogue is, now if I know, wow, I didn't even know there's 5 gears, but now I need to know how to talk to my partner about those gears and expand what we can do sexually. So I couldn't agree with you more. Now, we get a lot of questions. There's a drive difference. There's a higher, you know, you've always been told there's a higher drive partner, a lower drive partner. So when somebody says, I love my partner, we have this intimacy, but I just don't desire him and her the same way. Either their body has changed or some other things are going on. So they're in a loving relationship and they have no problem with arousal, but they don't physically desire their partner in the same way. I think that is a challenge for many couples therapists when they're working with a couple where it's not a arousal or mechanical issue.
And in fact, the old model was poisonous for treatment. The old model was to increase the desire of the lower desire partner, no matter what the gender or sexual orientation. The new model thinks about desire discrepancies as a couple issue. And that's where, again, the model of marriage therapy or couple therapy and the model of sex therapy needs to blend rather than be adversarial. The general approach among couple therapists is to increase the desire of the lower desire partner and to have more frequent sex. It's a mistake. The much better way of thinking about it, both relationally and sexually, is to see desire as a couple issue, that there isn't a good person, the higher desire partner, and a bad person, the lower desire partner, but that it's a challenge for both people. And the challenge for the low desire partner is to expand their repertoire of what they mean by sexual. The other really big challenge for the low desire partner is to accept and validate asynchronous sex. What everybody wants, and I think, and I agree with them, is you want a sexual experience where both people feel high degrees of desire, high degrees of pleasure, high degrees of eroticism, and high degrees of satisfaction. That is the best kind of sex. But it's not the typical kind of sex. Most sex in couples' relationships is asynchronous. It's good, but it's better for one partner than the other. So for the lower desire partner, the notion is not about frequency. It's about the process of pleasure, that you want them to find their sexual voice and to enjoy touching and sexuality in a more variable, flexible way. You also want them to, you want to say very loud and clear to both of them that duty sex, doing it for the sake of the partner, even though it's not good for you, is really bad for sexual desire. Let's take the traditional approach that it's the man who has a higher desire than the woman. Although I think you'd be surprised by the number of men who are the low desire partner, but it's the same basic therapeutic approach. So what you want is you want this understanding that sexuality includes sensual, playful, and erotic touch. And you need to find your voice about what is good for you. Do not do something that is bad for you. So on that 10-point scale, if the sexual experience is a 10 for your partner and it's a 5 for you, that's okay. But if it's a 10 for your partner and a minus 5 for you, it's not okay. Don't do something that's unhealthy for you personally or relationally. That is an important message. And understand that your approach to sexuality is not in comparison to your partner's approach. It is accepting that responsive desire and variable flexible sex is first class sex. The challenge for the high desire partner is to get off the pedestal that they're the better person, that they view their partner and their relationship in this variable flexible way, including turning toward each other when you have a mediocre, dissatisfying, or dysfunctional experience, not blaming and not shaming. For the higher desired partner, it isn't about frequency. It's about quality of pleasure. It's about frequency and quality of pleasure, not about did we had intercourse or we didn't. Defining sex specifically only as intercourse is a terrible problem for everybody, not just the low desire partner, but the high desire partner too. It doesn't give you a common ground in which to dialogue and to experience. So let me give a couple of examples.
Please.
One of the scenarios that I think is so helpful in terms of arousal and orgasm is the hand override technique, where the lower desire partner puts their hand over the higher desire partner's and shows them what kind of touch is pleasurable, what kind of touch is erotic, what kind of touch might lead to high arousal and orgasm. Those are very different phenomena. But this idea that you're the expert on your sexuality and you're going to share it with your partner is an empowering exercise. The other is to have them have an experience where the higher desire partner was orgasmic, the lower desire partner was not orgasmic, but the lower desire partner found it more satisfying. Again, I'm a tremendous fan of arousal and orgasm for both men and women. But orgasm is not the best measure of satisfaction. The best measure of satisfaction is feeling good about yourself as a sexual person, more energized and bonded as a sexual couple. That's what I want to emphasize. And for many people, especially the high desire partner, that is a really groundbreaking experience to know that their partner was more satisfied than they were, even though they were orgasmic. So you want to get them not only talking the same language, but having experiences that honor the diversity of their sexual experiences.
I couldn't said it any better. We also have a lot of couples come in to see MFTs where they've gone, they have a sexual issue, they've gone to their doctor, they've gotten a medical rule out. Many have gotten what the field heralded as the magic pill, Viagra or Cialis, but so many couples come in and say, okay, we got the Viagra or Cialis. My partner can get an erection, maybe a better erection they've ever had before, but it doesn't help our desire. Our sex is still not satisfactory.
They have sex that isn't worth having. They have
exactly.
Sex that is predictable, but not satisfying. So, you know, when I think about good sex and good sex therapy, I talk about it as a psycho-biosocial model of sexuality. Psychologically, what promotes healthy sexuality and what subverts it. Biomedically, what promotes it and what subverts it. And socially, relationally, what promotes and what subverts. And that the medical issues need to be addressed. There's all kinds of things that can interfere with sexual function. The best example, specific behavioral example of that is smoking. One of the ways of getting people to stop smoking is to say to them, smoking is bad for your penis, or smoking is bad for your vulva, which is true. Anything that's bad for your vascular system is bad for your sexuality. big mistake that people make is they ask the medication or they to do more than it can do. The good news, again, is there's no illness, no disability that stops you from being sexual, especially about desire. But the, asking a medicine to do it all is asking the medicine to do too much. You've got to integrate the intervention medically with your couple sexual style. So, for example, with Cialis, think about your work that you've heard from clients. Almost no client says to you, the physician told me that 85% of the time, the sex is going to flow to intercourse, but I can still have a good time when it does. They never use that 85% or any other number. It's a kind of a notion that says, I'm getting there. Cialis will give you back total predictability in terms of erection. And once you have erections, then you're going to have desire. It's not true. Desire and positive anticipation is the core thing that you want to change. And the Cialis is a resource that is a valuable resource, and it both increases the efficacy of the vascular system, but it also is a good placebo. It reduces your performance anxiety, but it can't do it all. Again, you want to empower your couples to use all their resources, biomedically, psychologically, and relationally. And one of the major resources relationally is, and whether you're talking about male or female sexual problems, is do you think of your partner as somebody who loves and accepts you, whether you're sexually functional or not? And sexually functional does not mean 100%. Sexually functional means I love that 85% criteria. And when it doesn't flow, you can still have a good time sexually. That's what increases people's satisfaction, but it also increases their desire. Because they say, nobody ever told me that sex is not going to be dynamite. I love dynamite sex. I love dramatic sex. But most sex is not dynamite and it's not dramatic. But it is pleasurable and it does energize you. And desire is a core issue.
Yeah, because as you said, you can take Cialis and you can have intercourse, but without this erotic flow that really drives the desire and makes sex so much more meaningful and powerful between couples. What do you think? You got in on the field in the ground floor. You were a pioneer in the 70s. In the last 50 years, the biggest changes in the field, and where does the field need to go in the next 10, 20 years?
I think the field needs to go to promote positive, realistic expectation. I think the field needs to, the marital people, the relational people, and the sexual people need to work together. Let me try to say this respectfully, but in a confrontative way too. The major trap that MFT people fall into is that when they run into individual and couple vulnerabilities of the clients, rather than staying with the sexual focus, they revert back to a non-emotional relational focus. Rather than integrating the sexual intervention, whether it's non-orgasmic response, premature ejaculation, erectile dysfunction, sexual pain for both men and women, they drop it and they go to something they're more comfortable with, which is relational dynamics. What I want the field to do is I want them to affirm that the healthiest relationships, again, straight or gay, married or part, are satisfying first, secure second. Secure is very different than stable. Secure means you value your partner, value the bond. There's all kinds of stable couples who don't value their bond. And the third is being sexual, that you want to see the sexuality as integrated in your work with satisfying, secure relationships. It is not like the Democrats and Republicans, a different conflict. It's the integration. And it's the recognition that pleasure is the measure, and that responsive desire for most people most of the time is more teachable and more genuine than spontaneous desire. So I would emphasize desire and satisfaction much more going forward. Now, where I think the field has gotten off track has been to ignore the core issue about desire. And I think that we've got to reinstate that as the core issue sexually and affirm that whether you're talking about mainstream sexuality or you're talking alternative sexualities, that the question is, what is the right fit for that couple in terms of the sexuality? I think that the old fight needs to be confronted and totally dropped, where the marriage people or the couple people would say to the sex people, you only care about sexual minorities and about eroticism. You don't care about real life couples. And the relational people or the sex people, when they attack the relational people, they'll say, you support family, not relational vitality. You support stability, not vitality. You need to integrate these in a way that is pro-sexual, pro-relational, again, whether it's traditional relational or alternative or sexuality relation.
It's really a both and rather than an either or. What we need is better integrated training, as you're saying. It's hard to argue with what you're saying. The couples therapist to me would be remiss if I didn't ask this one question. You are known for your standalone work, but also your collaborations with your wife, Emily, who I believe is a speech therapist by training. I'm curious of interviewing many pioneers and experts in the field and some husband and wife duos. How has she impacted your thinking on sexual desire over the years? And what is that personal and professional partnership like?
Emily and I married at the exact age of our cohort in 1966. I was 23, Emily was 21. We knew that the odds were against us in terms of having a healthy marriage and a healthy sexuality. We had talked about the fact that we came from very difficult cultures and difficult family backgrounds. But we said, we're going to beat the odds. We're going to try to create a healthy marriage. And we really do mean that. And we're going to work together to beat the odds. Now, we had very different professional approaches. And at the beginning, one of the things that I did years and years ago, pretty stupid, is I tried to talk her into switching careers and getting into the marriage and sex field. And she said, she went to a convention that I set it up. I did all the administrative things to get the tickets and all this kind of stuff. And she didn't have to worry about the child care or anything. And it was a fun trip to Marco Island, Florida. And after my two-hour presentation, which Emily went to, an older couple asked us out for tea. And the woman of the older couple, who was a sex therapy person, said to Emily, have you had a real orgasm? And Emily said, they don't ask that question in speech therapy conferences. But she tried to give an answer. And a woman said to her, you don't have to be on the defensive. Women cannot have orgasms unless they've been in a psychoanalysis at least 5 years. As we were walking on the beach after that, Emily said, this was a very helpful meeting that I've gone to. I am not going to join a field that says to women, you're not having the right kind of orgasm. A field that says you don't validate people. So what she has done for my life and my professional work has been to give it a humanistic viewpoint, a practical, realistic viewpoint, a pro-sexual's viewpoint, but also the idea that sex is not the only or the major thing in people's lives. And she really buys this idea and helped me buy the idea of the paradox of sex, that the role of good sex is small and energizing, but bad sex is really harmful. And you've got to confront the bad sex and get rid of the poisons, and you've got to promote healthy sexuality. So she has helped me be much more humanistic and much more measured. And we take great pride in that we've been married now 57 years. And it's a genuine, satisfying, secure, and sexual marriage. And we do take great pride in beating odds. So it's been a lot of fun. Person that's actually had more impact on my sex therapy writing and work is not my wife, Emily. He was my person I wrote books with, Mike Metz, who was a wonderful clinician and a wonderful writer. And what Michael did is he's the guy who came up with the idea of the good enough sex model, which I think is one of the most empowering thing that can unite both couple therapists and sex therapists.
The reason I am doing this show for the last 6 years and interviewing the pioneers is that people, it doesn't matter if you're 80, you are still as vital and passionate about the work
today as you were when you got in on the ground floor of this field in 1969. If listeners would like to follow up and learn more, Barry, you have many books and resources out there. What would you suggest to, if you were turned on, metaphorically speaking, by this conversation today, where would you go next if you were a listener?
I have a perceptual motor learning disorder, so it's very hard for me to type or use computers. But I actually have a website that's called McCarthy on Sex that has all of our books and ideas about some of these things. In terms of the best book that we've written for the lay public, it's called Rekindling Desire. It's a third edition. It's got some really great psychosexual exercises to help couples work together to rebuild sexual desire. There's two books we've written for the professionals. The clinically oriented book, I hate the title, but it's a good book. It's called Sex Made Simple. But the book, if you're more academic, was written after Mike Metz died. And Michael, right before he died, said, I want you to do something for me, and that is to make sure this book gets published. So it's Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Sexual Dysfunction. And the first author, even though he was deceased at the time, is Metz, M-E-T-Z.
Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast. Barry McCarthy, thank you very much. You know, we get a lot of questions about how you get continuing education from AAMFT. And if you're a member, there's a huge discount to that. And even if you're not, it's a place to go after you've heard a podcast like this to get more information. And the online learning platform for AAMFT for the last 7 years has been called Tenio. And that can be found directly on AAMFT.org. So if you want to dig a little deeper around sexuality, sexual desire, you can go to Tenio and get a 1.5 CEU, Sexual Desires Issues in Couples Therapy, presented by Melissa Fritchie. AAMFT has you covered in all your on-demand CEU needs. But perhaps you want to plan a little summer trip and you miss face-to-face gatherings. So AAMFT has you covered on that too. The Institute for Advanced Systemic Family Therapy, June 26th through 28th in Seattle, the Great Pacific Northwest, where you can earn up to 18 hours of continuing education. It's designed as an intimate and in-depth training for advanced clinicians to connect. The schedule allows both intensive training from experts and to enjoy everything that the local surroundings in Seattle has to offer. Participants study in one of four intensive courses that reflect clinical challenges that as MFTs we face today, and the institutes are designed with the experienced clinician in mind and presented by experts in the field, where the classes are kept intentionally small to create this really personal and interactive setting. I had the experience of being able to go to one of those institutes a couple years back, and it's a one-of-a-kind training experience, both for the people that you meet and from what you learn to add to your clinical tool belt. Go networks.amft.org/institutes/home, and you will see everything you need to know about the Institute for Advanced Systemic Family Therapy this summer in Seattle. Did you know that AAMFT is active on your social media channels? Where they are, so you can follow the AAMFT on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, even LinkedIn. And you can follow me. I'm at Dr. Eli Live on X, formerly known as Twitter. You can also drop me a line, Eli@NorthstarCounselingCenter.com. Check me out at ELIKARAM.com, where you can find everything going on, including both two books released over the last couple years, the kind of heart and soul of this show, The Common Factors, Bringing the Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy with my colleague and AAMFT president-elect, Adrian Blow, and also my study guide / family therapy text. Everybody looking forward to taking that licensure exam. We got you covered there too. Also a series of trainings around, again, common factors, preparing for the licensure exam, integrating in couple and family therapy, EliCarum.com. Until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.